use similar techniques to what we've been seeing about Feynman diagrams and quantum field theory, but to address a different kind of questions in a different setting. So actually what I'm gonna talk about is mostly based on the first paper with Paolo Luffy, and then a couple of other things that will appear in the talk are based on two other papers that I wrote with two students of mine more recently. And the parallel story on quantum field theory that I was talking about last time, well, I mean, I gave a few references last time, but one of them is this book that I wrote a few years ago that was kind of an introduction to this point of view. So what, what the setting is now, it's not quantum field theory, although I'll be sort of using the analogy with quantum field theory pretty soon. So it's, we're gonna look at kind of spin systems. Right? The prototype of the Potts model is the Ising model. So we have a graph, which for our purposes is gonna be a finite graph. Although in the end, most of the time you're interested in seeing what happens when your graph sits in some kind of family of graphs that becomes arbitrarily large according to some specified rule. But let's start with a finite graph. And you have a certain finite set of possible spin states. So the general Potts model is the case where you can have more than two possible spin states, and not just up and down, but a certain number Q of possible states. So you have a situation where you have a spin sitting at each vertex, which can have one of all these possible Q values. So the state of the system is an assignment of a spin state at each vertex of the graph. And then you have some kind of interaction. So the vertices are carrying the spins, and the edges are telling you where you have interactions. So two spins interact in this model if and only if there's an edge connecting those two vertices. And there's a certain energy carried by the edge that the energy of the system ends up in a sum over the edges of the graph. And the energy that's carried by an edge so wants to preferentially select the situations where the spins tend to align. So you take it to be zero if the endpoint spins are not aligned, and some minus if they are aligned. So actually there are two situations, right? There are actually two different cases. What I just said really refers to the ferromagnetic case, where you want to preferentially select the spins that align. And you can also have an anti-ferromagnetic case where you anti-select, so you prefer spins that don't align. So, okay. But anyway, that's you have a certain energy with these two possibilities with this rule, and it's convenient to actually write this energy in terms of certain variables that you attach to the edges, which are exponentials of this energy with a thermodynamic parameter beta, which is an inverse temperature. So you write them in this form. So in particular, this means that the range of these variables, which is physically relevant for the case of the ferromagnetic case, would be the case where all these variables are non-negative. And for the anti-ferromagnetic case, they are the case where they are negative, but only within this region between 0 and minus 1. However, I'm going to follow the same kind of principle that one does with the approach on quantum field theory that I discussed before. I'm going to start by forgetting that the physical range of these variables is only this one, and just complexify the variables so that I can do geometry with them. And then only at the end of the day, I'm interested in looking at the particular physical range. Okay. And so with this fact that you assign the energies like this, with this idea that it selects either the alignment or the non-alignment of spins, means that when you write the partition function for these Potts models, you can write it as a sum over all the assignments of spins, so all the states of the system, and then the corresponding energies for which are a product over the edges of these combinations with these variables associated to the edges. And it's a very well-known classical result that partition function can actually be rewritten as a famous combinatorial invariant of graphs, which is the multivariable TAT polynomial. So this is a classical result in statistical physics. So that partition function, you can rewrite it in this form. So the variable here, Q, is the number of states of the of spin states of the POTS model, and T is the collection of these edge variables that contain the energies of the interactions. And you have, so this is a sum over all possible subgraphs of G, not necessarily connected. And the power here is the number of connected components of the subgraph. And then you have a product over the edges of the subgraph with the edge variables. And now notice that when I write it like this, I'm really thinking of the parameter Q as a variable. So again, the physically relevant case is where Q is a positive integer, greater or equal to 2. But I'm going to treat it also as a complex variable and only kind of at the end of the day, you know, remember that the physically relevant things were the positive integers. So I have this polynomial. And this polynomial has the same nice property, in fact, in an even nicer form than the polynomial of graphs that I talked about, you know, that comes from the Feynman integrals. So it has this deletion contraction property. What I mean by a nicer form is that, you know, in the case of the graph polynomial quantum field theory, you have to make two somewhat special cases. In the case where the edge is either a looping edge or a bridge means that something that disconnects the graph if you cut it. Here, the same deletion contraction formula works on the nodes for all possibilities. So in fact, this property, and so one can show that this multivariable TAT polynomial is in a sense the universal invariant for a class of graph polynomials that pretty much satisfy a similar property. Those are called the Grothendieck TAT invariants, and what I mean by being universal is that any reasonable invariant of graphs that satisfies this property has to be a specialization of this one, where you specialize the variables. So I'm gonna say in a moment, more precisely, how the polynomial of graphs of quantum field theory that I talked about relates to this one. And that will give some kind of guidelines about what I'm going to do with this one based on what I've been doing with the other one. So what are now, in this setting, what are problems that arise naturally? So one thing that, of course, in these statistical physics models, one wants to know is phase transitions. So what are there, do you have? And it's known that if you are in the ferromagnetic case and you have a finite graph, you don't have any, so I'm gonna focus on a case where you have a zero of the partition function that signals a phase transition. So that partition function is in the denominator of your expectation values. So if it has the expectation values have a pole, if you have, so that signals the presence of a phase transition. And in the ferromagnetic case, if you have a finite graph, you don't have any phase transitions. And the reason is that, these polynomials, this polynomial has manifestly all positive coefficients, and if you evaluate it, and it has a non-zero constant term, so if you evaluate it anywhere on the non-negative quadrant, octal, whatever end of your space, with real non-negative variables, it's not going to have any zeros. In the ferromagnetic case, the interesting question then becomes, if you have not just one finite graph, but you have a family of finite graphs that become larger according to some specified rule. So if you can construct an infinite family of graphs by saying how the smaller ones are sitting inside the larger one, do you get phase transitions in the limit? And this basically boils down to having, so if you think of zeros of the partition function, what happens is that you have none inside this non-negative sector with non-negative real variables, but you have a lot in the complex, right? And what happens in that in the limit, some of those will fall into the sector where the physical transitions are. So basically what people study, and these are very difficult question. I'll come back later in a more quantitative sense to say what I mean by difficult questions. But basically, there's usually one does not have exact results, but there are numerical studies that show that indeed you have zeros that do in the limit fall into the sector where they represent physical phase transitions. The anti-ferromagnetic case has more stuff going on, because then you actually can have zeros of the partition function even for a finite graph that fall into the region where which is physical for that case, because those are not necessarily positive variables. And so there are several results. I mean, there's a long paper by Jackson and Sokal that does a lot of these trying to do geometric analysis or using a lot of combinatorial methods and so on, trying to establish at least constraints on where the zeros of these polynomials can be in the region. So that's one of the type of questions one wants to understand, or one wants to say as much as possible about the geometry of the set of zeros of this partition function. And why am I talking about a motivic approach? Well, obviously, because we have seen something similar somewhere else, in the sense that when I talked about the quantum field theory setting and this perturbative expansion in Feynman diagrams, I said that the contribution of each diagram can be written as a modulo the issues of divergences and so on, but can be written as a period of a certain algebraic variety. And the varieties, were complements of certain hypersurfaces that were defined by the vanishing of polynomial, in that case also a classical combinatorial polynomial of the graph, which happens to be this Kirchhoff polynomial, where you sum over, not over all subgraphs, you can always have some very special subgraphs, which are the spanning trees, and you take the product over edges in the complement of the spanning tree. And if the graph is non-connected, it means spanning tree in each component. So we've seen this polynomial also satisfies the deletion-contraction relation with a slight variation in the case of bridges and looping edges, which I won't get into. There's actually a related polynomial, which is just the one where you do the same thing, you sum over trees, but you take the edges which are in the tree, not the one that are in the complement. These two polynomials are very closely related. They are mapped to one another by this Cremona transformation that inverts the variables that I talked about in my first talk. So in a sense, what I mean by this is that since Cremona transformation is an isomorphism of projective varieties, it's from the point of view of the geometry, you can trade one polynomial with the other without losing track of what is going on. And the reason why I want to talk about this polynomial is because that's the one that is easier to describe, of which it's easier to describe the relation to the multivariable tat polynomial that I'm talking about now. So what we have been doing in quantum field theory is try to predict certain kind of numbers that arise from, as periods, as computation of Feynman integrals, by identifying them as periods, and so by trying to say something about the geometry of these varieties, and try to, in some sense, understand the complexity of the motive of these varieties, and on the basis of that, trying to make prediction on what kind of periods we're going to see. So, with this in mind, we're going to try to transfer some of these techniques to the setting of the POTS models. So, the way in which I've been talking about complexity of the motive of these varieties is by trying to say something about the class in the growth and decaying of the corresponding hypersurfaces. And just remind you from my previous talk, the growth and decaying of varieties is just like a slightly simpler form of motives. So instead of talking about motives, I will always now be talking about classes in the growth and decaying. And they are, so the ring is generated by isomorphism classes of algebraic varieties. And the relations are inclusion-exclusion, because I want to think of this really as some kind of Euler characteristic, and the product that's just a Cartesian product. And so, for example, no, I mentioned in my previous talk, this very nice result of Becal and Brosnan shows that the classes in the Grothendieck ring of the graph hypersurfaces of quantum field theory generate a certain localization of the Grothendieck ring. So this is saying that they can get arbitrarily complicated as motive as the graph increases in combinatorial complexity. Okay, so what I'm gonna do down the line in the talk is trying to relate what I'm calling here motivic complexity, which simply means trying to control how complicated the class in the Grothendieck ring of certain varieties become, with something which is more like a really computational complexity. Because in the end of the day, with this model thing, one is trying to compute where the zeros of the partition function are, often in some kind of numerical way. And so you want to try to be able to estimate how computationally hard this kind of problem is. And my point is that you can use some of these motivic techniques to get, in the end of the day, some estimates on computational complexity. Let me just say, I'm not going to say any more about quantum field theory. I've given enough talks about it. But I mentioned some of the references in my previous talk. I mentioned them here. Some of them are things that I talked about. Others, Karen has been contributing a lot to this topic. And other recent papers that are interesting on the subject. So there's a lot of results that are known for this quantum field theory setting. And as I said, what we're looking at is actually a different kind of questions, but we'll try to borrow as much as possible of the techniques to try to address them. Okay, so we're back to our post-model polynomial. So let me just say quickly how the polynomials that I talked about in the quantum field theory case relate to the polynomials of the post-model. So this polynomial phi of g, which is this like side variant of the graph polynomial, is actually a limiting case of the multivariable tuck polynomial. What I mean by a limiting case takes a couple of steps to describe. So the multivariate tuck polynomial has a sum over all possible subgraphs of your given graph. So what you can do, and by the way, unlike the graph polynomial of quantum field theory, which is a homogeneous polynomial because you're only looking at the spanning trees, and so the monomials that you pick all have the same degree, here you're looking at all possible subgraphs, so this is not a homogeneous polynomial. So in particular, from the point of view of algebraic geometry, it means that I cannot do projective geometry in this case. I can only work in affine spaces, but I cannot work in projective space because they're not homogeneous. You can always look at, if you have a polynomial that is not homogeneous, you can always look at the leading term, the homogeneous polynomial, which is the leading term in this sum. And in terms of which subgraphs you're summing over, when you take this leading term, it's like summing over subgraphs that are spanning forests. So they are forests and they contain the same, they have the same number of vertices as the total number of vertices. So that's already kind of more looking like the one I want. And there's only one additional step. So I still have here the dependence on the Q variable that I don't have in the other one. So I have to look at where that goes when I'm comparing those. So the next step is that so now I'm looking only at the locus of zeros of this leading term instead of looking at the whole polynomial. So the way geometrically, what am I doing? So I have a polynomial that's not homogeneous. I'm picking the homogeneous leading term. What I'm doing from a geometric point of view, I'm describing the tangent cone to this affine hypersurface. So the tangent cone, from the algebra geometry, this is an example, take a simple equation. It's an example of what I mean by tangent cone. So there are points where a variety does not have a tangent space, but it has a tangent cone because they're singular points. So this, what I've done so far is just, instead of picking this whole variety, I'm just looking at its tangent cone. And now I observe that this tangent cone, that I can, in this tangent cone, I can separate out the dependence on the Q variable and something else. So this tangent cone has a hyperplane, which is just coming from the zeros of this variable Q. So that part that has a certain multiplicity. And then it has another component. And the other component intersects this hyperplane exactly in the zeros of the polynomial of the quantum field theory. So that's the relation between these two polynomials. Okay, it's a little involved, but it's completely geometric, and it's completely clear geometrically. So in this sense, you can think of this variety that's defined by the vanishing of the Potts model as some kind of generalization of the variety that's defined by the vanishing of the polynomial that we looked at in quantum field theory, and you know exactly where these two are related geometrically. Okay, so you know what so let's see what we.
Is this new one better behaved than the one from final
data? No, actually, it's not. For example, I'm going to show it in a moment. But for example, you will find much earlier in terms of listing graphs by combinatorial. You will encounter very early examples that are not mixed state. Whereas with the graph polynomial of quantum field theory, you have to wait until very large graphs before you come across something. And it's in that sense, but I mean that's not surprising because mixed state is if I give you a smooth hypersurface of a certain degree, it's certainly not mixed state as a motive. So the fact that you have something of high degree that stays mixed state has a lot to do with being singular in some very bad way, which is what happens with the graph hypersurface. They have singularities in codimension 2, and they're very, so it's something that actually helps them stay in mixed state. Here, you're kind of, in a sense, because you have this other variable Q, which is now a variable as well, you're kind of smoothing it out a little bit. These are also not smooth in general, but they are sort of less singular than the other ones, in a sense. And so they're less likely to be mixed state than the other ones. So in fact, the examples occur much earlier. Also a very simple example where you already see it's not polynomial countable. Okay, but so for example, what do we want to do? So let's try to define the goals a little more specifically. Let's state like three kind of possible goals that one can get by this approach. So one is, as I said, trying to measure in some more precise way the complexity of the locus of zeros of these polynomials. And eventually, we want to turn this into some actual computational complexity for the problem of trying to find phase transitions. Another type of goal is to interpret certain kind of Gibbs averages that expectation values that you have in the statistical physics model, also as some kind of periods of motives, as we did with the Feynman amplitudes in the quantum field theory setting. And another general goal, which is similar to what I also talked about for the quantum field theory, is trying to construct certain simple operations on graphs that you can iterate in infinite families that will allow you to keep control on the hypersurfaces. Okay, so for this last thing, actually, for all these things, we'll see that there are certain very simple families of graphs over which you can control of all these things, like polygons, chains of polygons, and things like these banana graphs, and trees. But you can very easily lose control for very much the same reasons that I talked about in the quantum field theory case, lose control of how things go on graphs that are just a little more complicated. In particular, for the case of these Potts models, One of the cases that have been studied the most for the usual methods in post-model theory are the case of lattices, but unfortunately the case of lattices is a very difficult one from this perspective. Now, some of the other cases I listed are also being studied with the usual methods, and these methods apply better. But I mean, the prototype example of the lattices is one that for which these motivic approaches become very hard because you lose control of the growth and decline of the upper surface. Okay, so get a bit more into the details. So again, we're going to look at the hypersurface, which is the locus of zeros of this polynomial. And again, remind you that at this stage, I'm thinking of Q as one of the variables. I'm not thinking of it as a fixed parameter. I'll say a little bit later what happens if you fix Q and you just look at the T variables for a fixed Q. But for the moment, I'm just looking at all of them as variables. And so I'm going to look at the class in the growth and decaying of this hypersurface. And in fact, as it happens in the quantum field theory case, it's actually easier to write formulae if you describe the class of the complement. I mean, once you know the class of the complement, you know the other class, because in this inclusion exclusion is just a sum of the class of the affine space, and the other one is just that it makes the formula a little simpler. So I'm just going to give it a name. I mean, this curly bracket thing is just so that I don't have to write this long thing everywhere, but it's the class of the complement. So the first thing that happens is that you have exactly the same situation that I described for the case of the graph polynomials of quantum field theory, that you can use this deletion contraction relation for the polynomial to obtain something which is somewhat like a deletion contraction for the classes, but it's not because it contains this intersection term, which is in general not so easy to control. Notice that, I mean, it's not exactly the same argument as in the other case, because in the other case I was really using, well, I didn't go into the details of the argument, but I mentioned that the main thing we're using is the fact that each of the variables only appears of degree one in the polynomial. This is still true of the T variable here, but it's not true of the Q variable. So it's not exactly the same argument, because the Q variable plays a role that's different from the T variable. But still, you can still get the argument to work. And let me just quickly say how these kind of arguments work. They're very simple. But for example, you want to check. So you start by the fact that you have the deletion contraction for the polynomial. So you write the polynomial of G in terms of the polynomials of the deletion and the contraction. Now you start checking cases. Like, we're going to construct the class of the complement. So we want to see when this polynomial for the graph G is non-zero. So being non-zero means that whatever you have on the other side is non-zero. So what are the possibilities in which that can happen? So it can be because this last term is non-zero. And if the last term is non-zero, to make the total polynomial non-zero, it means that there's only one value of the variable T, E of the edge where you do the deletion and contraction that you have to avoid, which is the one that would make it zero. So you have a whole complex line minus one point of possible values for the variable TE, and you have all the possible things that make this last polynomial non-zero. So you have this term. L minus one is a line minus a point. There are all the possibilities for the variable TE, and this is the complement of the hypersurface defined by the polynomial of the contraction, so it's where the polynomial of the contraction is non-zero. So you have a term like that, and then, okay, if that is that instead is zero, then you look at what are all the possibilities, and you get all possible values for the variable T if the other one is also zero and whatever. So you get another full line for TE, and then you have the zeros of that last polynomial, which are not also zeros of the other one. Otherwise, the whole thing would be zero. So you, in the end, you add up all the possibilities, and that gives you a formula for the class. So that's how they are quite simple arguments. You just have to keep track of all the possibilities and then add them up. and that gives you the thing.
Is it similarly easy to do it for the motive? Is it similarly easy for the motive?
The motive, see, the reason why it's more complicated is because, so here you know that if you have, it's really a sum of something and its complement, right? So you can really break it down into possibilities. It's either like this or like that. So I have two disjoint sets, then the classes add up. In the category of motives, you still have that if you have two, that you have, but you don't have a sum. You have only like a long exact sequence in cohomology, right? Or it's like Meyer-Vitosa, something like that. But you have maps between them, which could be non-trivial, and unless you control it. So it's not, that's one situation where working with the class in the Groth and Decring really simplifies things, because you just add up things and you don't have to worry about maps between them and so on. So that, yeah, that's exactly why no one intends to use this way of here. So, okay, then, you know, you put all of, so that's pretty much how we get this kind of formula. So as I said for the quantum field theory case, you have the same situation. So even if these things are simple enough that you know them quite explicitly, the intersection, the class of the intersection, could be difficult to control. So there are some very simple cases, and just list so that one gets a sense, you know, what these things look like. For example, if you have a graph that's a single vertex, the complement of the hypersurface is just a line minus one point. If you have a single edge, and you know, either one or two vertices, then, you know, the graph of the complement, I mean the class of the complement of the hypersurface is L minus one square. But I will use the notation, I will at some point use the notation T for L instead of writing L minus one. The L minus one is the line minus a point, so it's the same as the C star, the multiplicative group. Okay, so I'll just write it as the one-dimensional torus to save notation. So for the moment, I'm just writing as L minus one. It turns out that a lot of formulae depend on L minus one, so it's convenient to use a simple name for that variable. So if you have so that's one thing that really differs from the quantum field theory case. In the quantum field theory case, if you have a disjoint union of graphs, then the classes of the complement of the hypersurfaces multiply. You're just a product. But here, if you have, and the same thing happens if you have two graphs that are just connected at the vertex. The classes of the complements multiply. But here they don't, because there's a variable Q that is, the point there is that the edge variables are all separate. But in this case, the edge variables are all separate, but the variable Q is the same. So there's a slightly more involved formula. But it's still true that it's the same formula, so it doesn't matter if they are joined at a vertex or they are disjoint. The classes are the same, it's just that it's not just a product. Also, if you join two graphs by an edge, you know, you just have the same as if they were disjoint, but multiplied by, again, this class of the torus. Yes. Okay, so these are really straightforward to verify just by looking at the polynomial. It's just a few simple cases that, you know, simplify the picture. Okay, so let me use this like I did for the quantum field theory case. Use this deletion contraction formula that I, you know, just described to identify the simple operations on graphs for which I can get rid of this troublesome term with the intersection and actually bootstrap the computation of the class for arbitrary repetitions of the same operations. So as in the case of the quantum field theory polynomials, I'm gonna look at two operations. One that is just splitting an edge by placing a vertex in the middle, and one that is doubling an edge by, you know, attaching another parallel edge. So you can see that if you iterate any number of times these two operations, for example, you get all the chains of polygons, you So you, there are certain, already some nice families of graphs that you can get just by using these two extremely simple operations. And the advantage is that these operations are sufficiently simple that you can get rid of the bad term. So let's first look at this edge splitting. So I have a graph, I just choose an edge, and I place the vertex in the middle. And I call G2 the resulting graph then where I split one edge into two. And so, okay, one, again, you just, I then use this deletion contraction formula that I just described and show that the class of the complement for the graph that you obtain is related to the classes of the graph that you start with and of the deletion and the contraction of the edge that you are doubling, and an additional term which is described by, again, combinatorially, by a sum over certain particular kinds of subgraphs. So those that connect the endpoints of E in some other way other than E. So the graph has to sort of go around, keep connecting the same vertices even after you remove E. Okay, that's what you get. But the thing is that you can also understand a little more explicitly what is the intersection of the deletion and the contraction in this case, because it's so what you get is that it's the same as the case where you contract the edge and the case where you just take the graph as it was, these two complements. And so what this allows you to do is, well, you can re-express this term in terms of these other pieces. And so you see that in this case, it kind of allows you to get rid completely of that intersection term and express everything, all the terms that you had in this formula, completely in terms of the graph, the deletion, and the contraction. Separately, not intersected. And you can iterate it as well. If you keep splitting, keep putting in vertices and times, you can again do the same kind of procedure, and you get a recursion relation where that expresses the number of splittings in terms of the previous splittings and in terms only of this variable t, which is the line minus a point. So that gives you, you can just solve explicitly the recursion and give a complete generating function for the classes. So this means that if you know the class of the graph that you start with, and you know the one for the first two splittings, then you know all of them through this formula. And so in particular, as a consequence, it has the fact that if you know that you start from a class that is in this mixed state part, then all the other ones will remain in the same main under iteration of this operation. And so it looks kind of, this something looks kind of funny here because I'm writing exponentials of motifs, but I mean it's a formal, just treat it as a formal variable, and then you compute the coefficients of this series, and those are the classes where it's like they're actually polynomials in T. Yeah. Okay, so there's the other kind of simple operation that has this nice property, this very similar nice property, is this operation of doubling an edge. So you have a graph, you choose one of the edges, and you replace it by two parallel edges between the same vertices. And again, you can see how the polynomials are related when you do this operation. And again, you play with this deletion contraction type of relation. And you can identify what happens when you do this one doubling, again, by checking all the possibilities and adding them together, exactly as in the previous cases. I mean, I'm not going to go really through the list, but I mean, it's the same type of argument that I said before. They all kind of work like this. And so it's very similar to what I just described for the splitting. With in the first doubling, you can write a relation between that comes from this deletion contraction relation, where again you have something that relates the class of the graph, the class of the graph where you have added this other parallel edge, and another term, which is a polynomial where you sum over, which combinatorially is described by summing only over certain subgraphs. In this case, it's the subgraphs that acquire an additional connected component when you remove the edge. And the procedure is again the same. You try to express all but this term with the intersection and this combinatorial term that occurs here in terms of the other one so that you get a recursion that does not involve that only involves the graph and its the deletion and contraction. So with a very similar story, so you can express these terms again in a recursive way only in terms of the hypersurface, the class of the hypersurface of the graph and of the one with the parallel edge, and then you have a recursive relation when you iterate n times the doubling of the edge. And again, you can explicitly get a generating function, which again shows that if it's another example that if you can control the class of the first terms in the recursion, then it always stays within this mixed state class. So this is good because so far it seems to work like the case of the quantum field theory. So there are at least these simple families of graphs which can become arbitrarily large in size, which is what you want for this statistical physics model, because you want to see the behavior on families of graphs that grow with a certain rule. So for example, chains of polygons are a good case or things like that. So more explicitly, you can use these, for example, if you look at polygons, you get with this method, you get an explicit formula for the class of a polygon. And that's manifestly a polynomial in the last term, the denominator actually cancels, so it's manifestly a polynomial in T, so it's a polynomial in L, so it's in the Tate part. The banana graphs, same thing, you have recursive formula, which also is a polynomial in the Lefschetz motif. So, okay. Well, let me comment for a moment on the role of the variable Q. So up to this point, I've looked at this hypersurface as zeros of this polynomial in the variables Q and T. So I've not treated Q as a fixed parameter, I've treated it as a variable. Now, if you look at some particular values of Q, you see that there are two values that are clearly special. The case Q equals 0 and the case Q equal 1. So neither of them is a physically relevant case because the post model with zero spin states or with one spin state is not very interesting. But from the point of view of the geometry, you'd see that if the case Q equals 0, you have a hyperplane component and the rest gives you the graph polynomial of quantum field theory. So this is the case that gives you back this tangent cone that I talked about before. So that's, you see, that's where the hypersurface of the quantum field theory case fits inside this hypersurface. You see, it fits in this section, Q is equal to 0, as one of this component. And in the case Q equal to 1, it's just a normal crossing divisor of the coordinate hyperplanes. Okay. So it's again the complement. It's a torus of dimension n. So okay, these two are not interesting. But then what about the general value of Q? That's what if I fix Q, which is not 0 or 1? So the best case scenario would be if you actually had a locally trivial fibration over the variable Q with these special fibers at 0 and 1. So at 0 and 1, you have something funny happening. But elsewhere, that would mean that your fibers kind of stays isomorphic as you move the Q. So it kind of doesn't matter where you specialize the Q, you sort of get the same. And so if you do a few calculations, at first it looks like it may be like that. Because for example, if you take the polygons or the banana graphs, you see that if you look at what formula you get for a fixed Q, which is not 0 or 1, you see something that is constant in Q. So at least the class in the growth and decaying stays the same. But of course, that doesn't mean that the varieties are isomorphic. If they are isomorphic, the class is the same, but you can have things that have the same class, but the varieties are not isomorphic. So it looks promising, but it doesn't say much. In fact, it's actually not a locally trivial vibration. There are really simple examples where it's not a locally trivial vibration. So the simplest example is the tetrahedron graph. If you look at that graph and you write down the polynomial of the Potts model hypersurface, so an easy way to check that it's not constant, the class in the Grothendieck ring, as I mentioned in my previous talk, it's like a universal Euler characteristic. So any invariant that satisfies this inclusion-exclusion relation and product formula will factor through the Grothendieck ring. In particular, if you count points over a finite field, that factors through. So if you see that, if when you count points, you get things that are different, then the classes are also different. So one way of checking things is by counting points over finite fields. And so if you do it, for example, the field where p equal 11 for this graph, you see that it's manifestly not constant in Q, the number of points over FP. Yes?
Are those numbers obtained by using those recursive formulas for the classes?
No, in this case, no. That's one example where if you try to compute it with this recursive formula. So the thing is, the cases that are computed by that recursive formula, they really look like it is a locally constant vibration with respect to the variable Q. But so this is the simplest example that is not. So that's why I'm doing it with a different technique, which is just counting points over finite fields. And so this gives you a very simple example where it's not constant in Q.
So in this case, you know exactly what the variety is.
Yeah, you know exactly what the variety is. It's just that to compute the class, it's actually easier to count points in this case. So it just tells you that the class is not constant. If the counting of points is not, then the class also is not.
So this is
the number of points. So FP is the field with 11 elements. And I'm just taking a prime that's sufficiently small, but it's not like two or three, usually it might have. And those are the number of points in the hypersurface that are points over this field. And you would expect that. If this variety were a locally trivial vibration over Q, you'd expect the number of points to be constant in Q, which is not. So yeah. So also, this same example, this tetrahedron graph, gives you the simplest possible example where it is actually not mixed state also. And you can see that by counting, just from the counting of points, and that's why, I don't do it by computing the class, because, it's not going to be a simple expression. Okay? But if you count the number of points over different primes, and a priori you can estimate what the degree of a short premise. So if the class in the Grothendieck ring is in the mixed state part, then it's a polynomial in the variable L, which is the motive of a line, with integer coefficients. Okay. So if the class is of that form, when I count the number of points over a field with p elements, I'm going to find a polynomial in p with integer coefficients. And I can estimate a priori what degree that polynomial should have. So then it's enough that I choose enough different primes to determine all the coefficients of that polynomial. And if I can't find integer solutions, then it cannot be a polynomial in P, and so the class cannot be a polynomial in L. So it's not polynomially countable. that's the argument. So this, the argument works even if you cannot explicitly write the class. It just works because you cannot match the polynomial with the solution. So that's how you find it. So in this case, the bottom line is that unlike the quantum field theory cases where you have to go up to these 9 loops, 14 edges graphs before you find something that is it's not polynomial countable, here nearly the first thing you run into is not polynomial countable. So in that sense, they are not behaving better, but no, they are actually, or I don't know, I mean, depends what better means. But they're not simple. Yeah, okay. Anyway. Okay, so what can we conclude from this? So for example, let's look at some kind of numbers that you might wanna extract. So where you have some you're computing some expectation value of some functions of the parameters in the model, like these energies or which depend on these variables at the edges. So you computing this kind of averages. And suppose that you wanna further average these values on all the possible energies in a certain range. So for example, some kind of average like this. So we have a certain region of energies that you're looking at with the interaction energies that you're looking at, and you make an average of these expectation values. So these numbers now, by what I just said, they are expressible in terms of something that has this polynomial in the denominator, has a polynomial. So this is an algebraic differential form. Here I have some domain which let's assume is defined by algebraic equation in some way. So I can interpret that as a period. So what kind of period is it? As I said, we are just seeing that we get motifs that are complicated. But for example, if you have graphs that are like chains of polygons, or an example like that, for instance, arbitrarily long, then the class, we have just showed that the class stays mixed state in that case. And so everything is assuming that the polynomial I'm looking at and everything is defined over Q or over the integers, then I'm getting a period of Tate motive in integers. So similarly for these kind of graphs, for example. And so in these cases, I can conclude that the numbers I'm computing have to be combinations of multiple zeta values. So a priori, these thermodynamic averages on some POTS model, there's no reason why they should be numbers of that form, but in this case, they will be. And however, if you have a slightly more complicated graph, which as physically can occur, which is, for example, a chain of tetrahedra, just showed that the tetrahedron is something which is not mixed state. And so in this case, you're gonna find that whatever periods you are computing might be something else rather than the multiple zeta values, something that has to do with whatever the nature of periods of these other varieties are going to be. So that's one type of questions that you can look at from this point of view, is what kind of periods arise when you compute some of these thermodynamic averages over these POTS models. Okay, so this is one type of question that I wanted to briefly discuss. The other kind of question that I mentioned at the beginning has to do with these estimates of complexity for these models. So here there are basically two ideas that I wanna try to follow in this approach. So one idea is purely geometric. So it's the fact that, what are we trying to do? So we have this this polynomial. We're looking at these zeros. So first of all, we wanna look at the locus. So we are trying to zoom in on the zeros that will really be physically phase transitions. So this can be done in two steps. So one is, first of all, you wanna look at zeros where the variables are only real. So far we're in this larger complex setting, but now we wanna first specialize to where to the real locus of this complex algebraic variety. And then we wanna cut that with the region that only corresponds to the physical ones. the variables are bounded in certain domains. And okay, so there's two things I want to do. One is I mentioned in general, this is a general kind of fact that algebraic geometry over the reals is much more complicated than algebraic geometry over the complex numbers. So if in general, it's more difficult to know something about real algebraic varieties, the geometry of real algebraic varieties, than it is about, you know, the geometry of complex algebraic varieties. So if I want to understand, I mean, just topologically, you know, there are these famous problems about real algebraic geometry, like how many components, you know, a certain real variety has, you know, or the set of real points of a certain algebraic variety has, you know, can be extremely hard, even though the complex variety is perfectly well understood. And so what I want to try to do is get some kind of information, at least in an estimate kind of sense, on the geometry of the real points using invariants of the complex geometry. So that's one step. And then the other thing is that, you know, once I have the set of real points, I want to cut it off with certain regions. And so that's more like an evaluation problem, and for which I want to know how hard it is computationally. So the next step is that I want to have something that relates computational complexity to complexity in a topological sense of this set of real zeros. Okay, so I'm going to try to follow this point of view. And the starting point will be the complex variety of zeros of this polynomial. So, the starting point is that we try to use the class in the Grothendieck ring of this complex variety. So there are all these invariants that factor through the Grothendieck ring, like the Euler characteristic, the counting of points over finite fields. I just use that fact. There's another important invariant that factors through the Grothendieck ring, which is the Hodge numbers. So the Hodge numbers have to do with the decomposition of the cohomology in the holomorphic and anti-holomorphic form. And you can assemble them together. So if you pick a rank in the cohomology, you have the PQ decomposition, the Hodge number decomposition of that part. If you can assemble all of these together, summing like an Euler characteristic of alternating ranks, and you can put them together now as a function just of the P and Q, and you can form a polynomial out of these coefficients that in terms of a variable x and y to the power p and q. So it's like the generating polynomial for these coefficients. And it turns out that this is actually, coming back to the motive story, you know, if you want to think of those terms, like the class in the Grothendieck ring is like an Euler characteristic of the motive. And these guys are like an Euler characteristic of the mixed Hodge structures. So that's the way that the picture fits together. But anyway, if you want to allow for quasi-projective varieties that need not be projective, then you have to use this compact support homology. So the thing is that the Grothendieck ring of varieties, normally you define it as generated by quasi-projective varieties because you have, in the relations, you are taking complements. So you also have things that are not compact. So if you want to define something that will factor through the Grothendieck ring, you have to allow for that, the possibility of defining for a quasi-projective variety as well. But this works, and it actually gives you a ring homomorphism from the Grothendieck ring of varieties to polynomials in two variables with the integer coefficient. And so in particular, whenever you have some explicit formula for the class in the Grothendieck ring, you also have an explicit formula for the Hodge numbers by using this map. And so why do I want to use the Hodge numbers? Again, so this is the first step that I mentioned because I want to get some information about the locus of real points of the variety as a function of information about the complex variety. And there's a kind of, so as I said, you cannot do that exactly, but you can do that in an estimate sense. And there are several results which go generally under the name of Petrovsky-Olejnic inequalities that tell you that you can bound the topological complexity in the sense of Euler characteristic of the set of real locus of an algebraic variety in terms of the Hodge numbers of the complex variety. And so, you know, it's interesting because, you know, it tells you that the topology, you know, of the is not growing faster than, you know, the Hodge numbers of the complex variety. So the, however, okay, these estimate are, so the, in the smooth case, if you have a smooth projective variety, the estimate is fairly simple. It only involves one Hodge number. If you start to have things that have singularities, you have some more complicated combination of Hodge numbers. If you have isolated singularities, if you have singularities that are not isolated, are in higher dimension, then you still have some estimates, but they become, which again are related to Hodge numbers, but they become a lot more complicated. So I'm going to try to, because the problem is the varieties we deal with are very often singular. And they often are singular in a way that involves singularities of dimension higher than zero. And so I'm going to try to simplify this picture so that I don't have to deal with this most complicated case of these inequalities. So what else can I do if I don't want to go through these Petrovsky-Olejnic inequalities? Well, what other invariants of real algebraic varieties can I use that I know are going to be related to this picture of maps that factor through the Grothendieck ring? So there's a unique sort of motivic version of topological Euler characteristic that works for real algebraic varieties, and that is homeomorphism but not necessarily homotopy invariant. And it's obtained as the usual Euler characteristic, as alternating sums of the ranks of Borel-Moore Betti numbers. And it factors through the Grothendieck ring of real algebraic varieties. Now, so I'm going to look now only at the real locus. That gives me a class in the real Grothendieck ring of real algebraic varieties. Notice that it's not exactly the topological Euler characteristic. It's really like Euler characteristic of like a compactification. So the line becomes the Euler characteristic of a circle in this case, and so on. But okay, and this has there's a Betti number version. So there are these virtual Betti numbers, which are not, they're actually not the Betti numbers of Borel-Moore cohomology, although they also compute the same Euler characteristic because they can occasionally be negative. So they're sort of virtual Betti number in a sense. But they also factor through the Grothendieck ring of real algebraic varieties. So they do give you some estimate of complexity. And these virtual Betti numbers are related to the Hodge numbers. So I'm just repackaging the same information that I told you before about the Hodge numbers, but in a way that becomes a little, becomes independent of whether the variety has singularities or not. And so these virtual Betti numbers are sums of weighted Euler characteristics, which are these, again, sum of Betti numbers of the complex algebraic varieties. So, okay, the point of this is that now you can try to use what you know about the Grothendieck class to get some information about these Euler characteristics. Okay. So, and there's another good fact about this particular Euler characteristic that I just described, which is that there's a nice result that tells you that if you have an algebraic set in Rn, so for example, a real algebraic variety, the algorithmic complexity of this set, so the computational complexity of describing it algorithmically, is bounded below by the log of this Euler characteristic. So if you have a family of varieties and you can control how that Euler characteristic grows over the family, it gives you a bound from below on the computational complexity of this set of zeros. So unfortunately, the bound is almost never sharp. So there are examples where There are examples where the right-hand side is polynomial and the left-hand side is not polynomial. So it's not a necessarily good bound, but at least if you find that it's, you know, some very, very large polynomial, or that, for example, it tells you that, no, this cannot be simpler than that or something. Or if this side already happens to be exponential, then, no, you know that you are in some very high complexity class. So examples. Let's look at these polygon chains that I just discussed before, and we computed the class in the growth and decaying of the set of zeros of the hypersurface, and so I mean the set of zeros of the postnodal polynomial, and so we can use that to compute this Euler characteristic with compact support of the set of real zeros. And we see exactly that it grows. So this grows exponentially according to a specific order. No, that depends on the length of the chain, so on the number of edges in each polygon and the length of the chains connecting the polygons. And similarly, you can compute explicitly the virtual Hodge numbers and so on. So in terms of the computational complexity, notice, I mean, these are exponential, but you have a log of that. So it's polynomial, but it gives a certain order of the polynomial, how the order of the polynomial changes with the length of the chain. So that's the kind of estimate that you can get. Similarly for these banana graphs, you get this, again, a polynomial that depends on where the order depends on the number of edges that you have and on the length of the chain connecting them. So that's the kind of other, you know, questions that I think one can try to, you know, work on with this sort of model. You know, what can one improve these estimates of complexity somehow by trying to understand better these invariants, these motivic invariants, and the classes in the growth and decaying of these varieties. And let me just finish with one more thing. So there are variants of these POT models where you input some more physical information. So for example, you can have a nice case is where you look at a POTS model with an external magnetic field. So in that case, what happens is that you still have the usual interactions where that tends to align the spins, but you also, the spins tend to align with an external magnetic field, which may be, you know, the simplest case is where it's constant, but it may not be constant. So it may be a function that varies at each vertex, and so it has an effect which interacts with the effect that you have along the edges. So you get some more complicated, you know, balance between the external magnetic field and the effect that comes from the interactions. So again, it's known that you can write the partition function for the POTS model with external magnetic field in terms of a combinatorial polynomial of the graph. Now the polynomial has a different set of variables. So you still have the edge variables that come from the interaction energies on the edges. And now you have a set of variables associated to the vertices and the function that describes the magnetic field, the external magnetic field. So the resulting polynomial is again a sum over subgraphs. But now, instead of having a power of the variable Q that correspond to the number of components of the subgraph, you have a product of variables which come from the way the magnetic field is distributed over the various over the vertices, and then you have the usual term with the interaction energies along the edges. And so this is again a polynomial that has this nice deletion contraction type of property, so you can pretty much do the same things that I've been doing with the other before. So the way that you interpret this physically as the partition function is by thinking of this term. So that's the usual way you interpret the edge variables as interaction energies. And these, the vertex variables come from the magnetic field and the configuration of the magnetic field. And so these polynomials define hypersurfaces, and you can try to look geometrically at these hypersurfaces and extend the same questions from the traditional post-model to the case with magnetic field. You just have to keep track of these variables of the magnetic field as well. And so the same thing works. So for example, you have the same deletion contraction relation. You have the same recursion, pretty much exactly the same recursion formulas for the doubling of edges and splitting of edges. But you have a different seed for the recursion because you start with a different polynomial at the beginning. And so for example, you know, if you look at the banana graph, very simple example, you see that with magnetic field, the class has a certain form, which is it's a Tate motif, but it's not the same one as the one without the magnetic field, because you start from a different point to run the, you run the same recursion, but from a different starting point. And there's another difference from the case without the magnetic field. So one is that you encounter non-polynomial, non-mixed state things even earlier, because you know you can, and moreover, the mixed state or not can vary according to how the magnetic field varies. So a very simple example, if you take a triangle graph and you take one case where the magnetic field is constant everywhere and you take a case where it's different at the different vertices, you can arrange it so that in one case it's not polynomially countable and in the other it is. And the reason is because you can change the degrees by which these variables that correspond to the magnetic field appear. And roughly, I mean, here you see a cubic polynomial, which you know, pretty much is telling you that there's an elliptic curve appearing, which is not a Tate motif. And in the other case, you only get quadrics and lines, which are Tate motifs. So the behavior of the motif now is sensitive to the shape of the magnetic field in the model. And this is another issue that now is a different phenomenon with respect to the one in the scene before. And also you can study some of these computational complexity questions in this setting. So you can do the same things that I did before, which I'm not repeating here. But another thing you can do is, for example, if you want to just test if a certain number is a zero or not, so if a certain number is a phase, if a certain point is a phase transition or not, you're looking at what is the computational complexity of evaluating these polynomials at a point. And already that you see that, you know, if so for example, the behavior can change a lot according to the shape of the graph. So two very simple examples, if you take a polygonal graph, then this evaluation problem is tractable in the size of the polygon. So the complexity grows polynomially as a cubic polynomial in the number of edges of the polygon. But if you take a binary tree, it's NP-hard. So it's already, you know, they're just testing whether a given point is a phase transition or not. It can be NP-hard for some fairly simple graphs that are fairly simple to describe. Okay, so I mean, I finish with this. I want to say that there are other ways in which people have been looking algebra geometric at POTS models, but they have a different flavor, which has to do with, you know, trying to describe, you know, with algebraic curves, the rapidity curves for the kind of post model and so on. There's some very nice algebra geometric stories that come out from that point of view. But at this stage, I don't know if there's any interesting relation between that algebra geometric approach to POTS models and the one that I've been talking about here. So I just want to mention it because, you know, if you're seeing this algebra geometric approach before, and wonder if it's related or not, the answer is I don't know. So that's another question. So that's part of the question of what other things one can do. One is to actually try to understand if there's a connection between these two different approaches. Another thing is, you know, in POTS models, one often uses these transfer matrix methods. I don't know if those have a motivic interpretation or not. And also, another algebra geometric method one can use to try to locate zeros is using these residues. So you have, if you want to know if there are zeros in a certain region, you can sort of integrate on some cycle that goes around that region. And if you pick up a residue, then there was a zero there. And so that's another technique that I think is well suitable for sort of algebra geometric, you know, methods. And so that's where, you know, things stand up to now.
one example which had an elliptic modus.
You mean the one where you change the magnetic field, or
yes.
Yeah.
Was the tetrahedron graph also elliptic?
Hmm?
Was the tetrahedron graph also elliptic?
So this is simpler. It's just a triangle graph. But I think, yeah, you can do it also with the tetrahedron graph. And
the previous example of the
The tetrahedron graph is already non, is already non-mixed state without the magnetic field.
Yes,
so, oh, you mean, can you make it mixed state by changing the magnetic field?
No, I'm wondering if it's an elliptic curve also.
Oh, if it is an elliptic curve. You don't see the elliptic curve explicitly when you write the way the polynomial looks. I suspect that it may be just because it's the simplest kind of non-mixed state thing that you can run into, and the graph is fairly small, in the quantum field theory case, the first thing that comes up, which is not mixed state, is actually a K3 surface. And which is kind of like an elliptic curve, just one dimension up. And so it's quite likely that what it is might be probably an elliptic curve, because it's this much simpler situation, and or something that's pretty close to being an elliptic curve. Like here, we kind of sort of manifestly see that it's that's what's happening. But yeah.
Okay.